Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With the shaken European markets causing tremors on Wall Street and the stock market dropping 513 points after a week of losses, we will talk with former Wall Street banker William Cohen, who covers Wall Street for Fortune, Vanity Fair, and the New York Times. He recently wrote the book Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. Then economist Randall Ray joins us for a macroeconomic analysis of adverse economic trends at home and abroad amid dire predictions of a double-dip recession in the United States and defaults in Europe. We'll try to connect the dots and see if we are indeed at a Smoot-Hawley moment where the Congress, instead of reversing economic decline, has accelerated it. Then historian Robert McIlvaine, the author of The Great Depression, America 1929 to 1941, joins us to explore further analogies between what happened to prolong the Great Depression and actions just taken on Capitol Hill that most analysts say will deepen and drag out the recession. Joining us now is William Cohen, author of the new book Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohen is a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair in the New York Times, where he covers financial issues. His acclaimed book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company, and he worked on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Laissez Faire and J.P. Morgan Chase. In 2007, he published The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Laissez Faire and Company. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohen.
Hey, nice to be here, Ian.
And what kind of a day is this in terms of the, you know, the reasonably frequent meltdowns on Wall Street? This is 513-point drop after a week of losses. Everybody's saying it's the worst since the crash of 2008. What's your take on it?
Well, first of all, I mean, your point about these episodes happening with increasing frequency is an important one. I mean, yes, okay, it's the worst one since 2008. That was only fewer than three years ago, and already we're into another round of crisis. And I think it goes to, unfortunately, the rapidity, the seriousness of these crises, and how quickly they come, and why we don't do anything in the interim to try to prevent it from happening again. I mean, it's a scary day to some extent, but it's also, I think, a very healthy day, because I think that there's no question that the stock market, since March of 2009, has increased from something like 6,500 on the Dow to close to 12,700, 12,800 before this correction over the past week. And so, I mean, I think, you know, it had risen almost twice in the period of just over 2.25 years, and I think that is an extremely rapid rise and one that called out for a correction. I mean, you know, let's not forget, Ian, I mean, you're south of Silicon Valley, but, I mean, you know, we're going through this extraordinary period over the last 6 months where these, you know, social networking companies have been valued at increasingly nosebleed-type valuations. I mean, in January of this year, Goldman Sachs put in new money into Facebook that valued Facebook at $50 billion, and already 6 months later, people are talking about it being worth $100 billion. And then there's Groupon and Twitter and LinkedIn and, you know, the Zynga. The list goes on and on. And so we were, I mean, people were talking about this return of the bubble mentality, and that's a reference to stocks being overpriced. So I think it's, you know, while it's scary, I think it's utterly healthy for our markets and our economy.
Well, William Cohen, some people think, though, it's a sign of worse things to come. Alan Sinai, the chief global economist at Decisions Economics, he's making the analogy with Japan. In other words, we had the subprime meltdown here, and he's saying much as the end of the real estate boom in Japan in the 1990s set that country up for the so-called lost decade, the realization is dawning on the world that the future of the United States is bleak.
I often find, Ian, that it's very hard to predict the future, right? I mean, so we don't know whether
that's Yogi Berra, right?
We don't know whether somebody like Alan Sinai, who's obviously very respected, in this instance is more like a broken clock that's right twice a day, or whether in fact he is accurately summarizing the situation in the future. But let's just take the events of the last week. Okay, we've unfortunately had to bear witness to this horrendous debacle in Washington, this utter self-inflicted wound where, you know, the Tea Party, members of the Republican Tea Party brought us to, you know, within days of default on our debt obligations. So, you know, at the end of the last 2 weeks, the bond market is basically, for lack of a better word, been freaking out. And people didn't know whether to, you know, buy into treasuries because, the treasuries market has always been sort of the last bastion of safety, or to flee treasuries because they're about to be defaulted on. So you had this, you know, totally schizophrenic behavior. And then it gets resolved on Sunday night, Monday, and Tuesday. And all of a sudden, treasuries are looking safe again. And people had been fleeing treasuries and putting money in the stock market because the stock market, you know, provided yields, provided returns that the bond market wasn't providing because it was so overpriced and people had driven down the yields to such low levels. And so the crisis gets resolved and people say to themselves, you know what, treasury securities are back being safe again. And I'll put my money there even though the yields are low, and I'll take it out of this risky stock market because, which has gone, by the way, from 6,500 to 12,700, because I'm not sure what's going on in the world economy. We've got, you know, disasters brewing in Greece, Italy, Spain, Ireland, Iceland, Portugal, and, you know, often these things get exported, and if you look to history, they often get exported around the world. Just like our mortgage crisis got exported around the world, their problems could get exported around the world, and we were in the process of incurring a self-inflicted wound, and, you know, people just said, okay, we've avoided that, now I'm going to take some risk off the table. And so it's inevitable that they would take it out of stocks, which are incredibly high priced. If you look at a 10-year average of P.E. ratios of U.S. stocks, right now we're still close to 21 times 10-year rolling average, when it should be closer to 19 times if you look at the history. And so there's still more to fall here. I mean, stocks have been going up without really any correction since March of 2009. And so this was, you know, long overdue, frankly.
Again, I'm speaking with William Cohan, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. And we're talking about, of course, the drop of on the Wall Street today of 513 points on the Dow, dropping an average of 4.3% during the day. Standard & Poor's 500 index lost 4.8%. And, of course, this is at the end of a week of declines, but it's clearly been precipitated by what preceded today's trading on Wall Street in Europe, right? Things are certainly not encouraging in Europe. Interest rates on Italian debt rose to fresh highs, and the Italian stock exchange plunged. I'm just trying to get a sense here. I've talked to a few economists recently, William Cohan, who suggest that if you sort of connect the dots all around with dysfunctional government in Washington, there's no question of what was achieved out of that near-death experience precipitated by the Tea Party is going to slow the economy, if not grind it to a halt. So there seems to be a lot of factors out there, and also with Spain and Italy. They're not Greece. Greece is already gone, right? It's gone over the cliff. But Spain and Italy are too big to fail and too big to bail. I mean, that's the third and fourth biggest economies in Europe. So just give us a sense of what's looming out there in terms of these financial icebergs.
Well, I mean, there's no question. You look at the yields on Italian debt and on Spanish debt, and they're starting to climb precipitously. I'm sure credit default swaps on those securities are also climbing. That's the insurance that one buys. I mean, you know, since the U.S. solved its or put the bandage on this self-inflicted crisis that we were working on, you know, it's very clear that people want to find the safest a place to put their money. And you see this very interesting decision by Bank of New York Mellon today to start charging, you know, fees on people who keep more than $50 million, you know, in their account. Now, I know that that might apply to you, Ian, but that does not apply to most people. And the fact that they're, you know, going to charge people for safety just indicates, you know, and then if you look at the way the Treasury market is trading and how low the yields are getting there, I mean, 2 weeks ago we were in negative yield territory again, which is something we didn't see until since, you know, September of 08 when the money markets froze. So people are once again very, very nervous, and they're putting their money in what they perceive to be the safest place they can find, which, you know, now on Thursday it is Treasuries. On Monday it may not have been, but on Thursday it is. And so, you know, you have this fear that is now unlike, frankly, in September of 08, which was basically a U.S. problem at that time. Now you've got, you know, economies in Europe sort of imploding, and so people are retreating from that market and putting their money into treasuries. And so the natural thing is to just retreat from, you know, people have seen this movie so many times now, Ian. That you know, it's just incredible to me if you think back how many times we've seen these plunges since, you know, October of 87, you know, 24 years ago. You know, how often we get these crazy Wall Street stock gyrations. The people, you know, are just saying, you know, I don't want to take this kind of risk anymore, and they'll move out of stocks and put their money into treasuries and safer securities and ride it out. And then, but the interesting thing I have to say is that behavior, and you know, for smaller shareholders, you know, the history has also been that if you sold, you know, at these troughs, you lost money because you sort of perfected your losses, and if you just held on, it seems to me that the market, you know, generally will bounce back. It may take time, and that often is what happens. And so just like if you had taken your money out of the stock market in February of 09 when the market hit 6,500, you would have lost the next doubling that occurred from then until now.
So given, William Cohen, that that so much of what happens on the market is driven by perceptions and panic, if you will, and you're suggesting that the small stockholder may be buffaloed into selling, and I don't think a lot of people have the patience the forbearance to hold on to things when it looks like the whole thing's going down. Now, just when you've got people, some of these fairly prominent Wall Streeters, just in the last couple of days, have been saying stuff, and I just want to run them by you quickly. Head of PIMCO, the big bond guy, says that the U.S. economy is like a plane; it's at stall speed; it could just stall and crash. Meredith Whitney, the municipal bonds guru, she's saying that we're in double dip. Now, because of today's activities, the head of strategy at the Royal Bank of Scotland is saying that now the double dip was about 1 in 20, and now it's down to 1 in 3 as a possibility. Just give us a sense of those kind of predictions.
Well, and then of course it's the likelihood that S&P and Moody's and Fitch will downgrade the AAA rating of the U.S. government, which means that we'll have to pay more in interest expense.
And the Chinese have done that already, haven't they?
Well, the Chinese are basically, you know, moving to shorter and shorter term maturities on their treasuries so that they can avoid long term risk of our country. You know, but you know, the Chinese and we are sort of attached at the hip. I mean, there's no way out for them at the moment either. They have to believe that we will make good on these payments. But, you know, again, I get back to, you know, Alan Sinai's prediction. And, you know, far be it from me to question, you know, either Mohammed Al-Arian or Bill Gross at PIMCO. They're very smart, but, you know, they're bond guys. They like it when the bond market rallies and prices go up, and you know, so they of course are talking about, you know, making talk to encourage people to, you know, flee to safety and buy into treasury securities and bonds generally. I mean, you know, so again, I mean, yes, and we've engaged, you know, since the November 2010 election. You know, don't forget, elections have consequences, and you know, by electing all these intransigent Tea Party Republicans, you know, we've put ourselves in a position where, you know, basically we're in this total stalemate. So, you know, Bill Gross or Mohammed Al-Aryan, whoever at PIMCO said that, is absolutely right that we're in the danger of stalling out at the moment. But, you know, the question is, you know, is cutting, you know, is drawing attention to our fiscal house being in disorder? I mean, last time we went and did our best to try to balance budgets, which was during the Clinton administration, in the 93-94 time frame, you know, we got to a balanced budget by the end of the Clinton administration, and the economy was very, very strong. And so, you know, it might be that this recent bill which was passed, which was, of course, flawed because it did not raise taxes to help further reduce the deficit and only cut spending over a long time period, but maybe that nod towards fiscal responsibility will be the kind of message that combined with taking some of the air out of the stock market, will be the kind of message that you know, looks like that corporations in America have been waiting to hear, which is that, you know, for the first time it looks like Washington might be serious about trying to get its fiscal house in order. And again, the last time Washington appeared to be serious about getting its fiscal house in order, which was during the Clinton administration, the economy took off. So it's, you know,
there's a stalemate there now, William. I mean, on Washington, and I think I just wondered, though, that we're in danger here of talking about an economy that may be an abstraction to a lot of our listeners, since I don't think the recession ever ended for a lot of people in this country. The only people who seem to have recovered are the very wealthy. And when you talk about double dip, it's you know, to the people that have been unemployed since 2008, it doesn't mean anything. So give us a sense.
I completely agree with you. I mean, it's unconscionable that some of the policies that have been you know, ongoing, you know, between the Congress and the executive branch. I mean, the failure to bring unemployment in line, and the failure to properly stimulate, you know, the economy, and you know, get America growing again. I mean, you know, I interviewed Larry Summers at the beginning of the year. He predicted 3.5% growth rate for this year, and you know, obviously we're well below that. So the policies aren't working. But all I'm saying is that, you know, we're at a crucial moment, as we always seem to be, you know, in this economic recovery, and it seems very fragile, but, you know, could it be a double dip recession? Yes, of course it could be a double dip recession, but could it also be sort of a turning point which signals to corporate America, who've been waiting for a signal for, you know, years now, that Washington is serious about fiscal responsibility? Well, it could be that too. And if it is that, then they're going to start spending some of the $2 trillion of cash that they have on their balance sheets, and they're going to start investing in plant and equipment and hiring people again. And, you know, again, you know, I'm not being sort of argumentative or trying to just take you know, the contrary position, but you know, economists, you know, it's dismal science, is because people don't know, you know, mm-hmm. for sure. They'd never know whether you know, you're right or not until you're looking in the rearview mirror.
But just in closing, though, William Cohan, it seems to me that there's something else that the markets could be signaling with these drops, you know, today, and that is that Washington has just taken $2 trillion out of a sick economy, and that makes no sense economically, and we're going to have less demand, less employment. It's that simple.
Well, I mean, again, there's also $2 trillion in cash sitting on the sidelines in corporate balance sheets that could be put to work if they thought that Washington was serious about fiscal responsibility. You know, the truth is we have a very, very fragile economy. It's very driven by psychology. I do think taking some of the air out of the inflated stock market is a good thing. And, you know, I often find that these kinds of gas releases, while painful, end up working to the benefit of the economy. But our economy is in tough shape. I completely agree with you there. And I don't think anything that's happened in Washington in the last 6 weeks has done anything to help that. What the thing that actually might help at this point, believe it or not, counterintuitively, is some sell-off on Wall Street.
Well, William Cohan, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William Cohen, author of the new book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. He's a contributing editor at Fortune, a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times. His acclaimed book, House of Cards, Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company, and he worked on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Lazard Frere and J.P. Morgan Chase. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back at talking with economist Randall Ray.
Your cares and troubles are gone. There'll be no more from now on. Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again.
You seen the well-to-do up on Lenox Avenue, on that famous thoroughfare, with their noses in the air, high hats and colored collars, white vests and $15, spending every dime for a wonderful time. If you're blue, you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where Harlem sits, putting on the Ritz.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Let's now talk about the economy in a broader sense, in the sense of the global economy, how it's affecting Wall Street, with L. Randall Ray, a professor of economics and research director at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He also writes regularly for the websites Benziger.com, New Economic Perspectives, and New Deal 2.0. Welcome to Background Briefing, Randall Ray. And you're in New York, near Wall Street in Manhattan, at the Levy Institute. And let me following on from the last interview with somebody that knows Wall Street well, do you think this 513-point drop in the Dow today is a sign of letting off steam out of an overheated stock market, or is it, as I suggested, maybe Wall Street's saying to Washington, you know, you guys just took $2 trillion out of a sick economy, and it's just going to make things worse?
Well, I think probably there's a bit of both. I think the stock market has been in an unsustainable bubble, and it doesn't take much to cause some jitters and some sell-offs. But I think that you're right. With all the bad economic news that came out very recently, I think Wall Street started getting scared that all the focus has been on deficit cutting and there has been no focus on the real economy.
And do you think that message, surely, I mean, if the Wall Street people were watching these economic illiterates on Capitol Hill, the Tea Party types, threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States over the last month or weeks or so, and they weren't able to weigh in and stop it, presumably. I mean, they've got to be rational people. They have to understand that was the stupidest thing you could possibly do. You're actually telling the world out there, don't buy our treasury bills. I mean, that's what's been going on. So in that context, do you think that these powerful Wall Street guys, and we know that a lot of people argue that Barack Obama sold his soul to Wall Street, surely somebody from Wall Street is saying, you know, you guys are digging the hole deeper. You're not bringing the economy out of the doldrums.
Yeah, I think there's a mixed message going on because certainly last week, the view on Wall Street was this is all political theater. These guys are going to come to a so-called compromise that actually everybody wants, and they're going to do the deal. I think that they might have gotten shaken a little bit that the deal wasn't closed last week. But I think they viewed it as political theater. And I listened to the last couple minutes of your previous guest, and I mean, he lives in a different world, obviously, a different universe. But that is the universe of Wall Street and the Washington Beltway, which is that you've got to get your fiscal house in order. I heard him say that, and you hear this all the time. And they believe that just somehow magically, if Congress can agree on some huge deficit cutting down the road some piece, then magically business is going to just get enthusiastic and run out and start spending, even though they have no sales. People are losing their jobs. House prices are continuing to fall. That business is just a huge philanthropy, that they're all working for charity. It's bizarre.
Well, that's what I understand, is that, you know, that this economy will never get back on its feet unless there's employment and demand, which go hand in hand. I mean,
it's simple.
It's really simple. But so then you get to the question of, well, do they? Is this the new reality? I mean, is this you know, our step towards kind of an oligarchical America, where, you know, because the only people that, as far as I can tell, you know, they talk about we've recovered from the recession. Well, the people who've recovered are the people at the top, the very people who were rewarded over these last two decades, who crashed the economy and then got rewarded again. And now they're back on top, but the mess that they caused continues, and everything that the Washington has done recently is going to continue the pain for the many while continuing to reward the few.
Yeah, there was a recent very good study that showed that since the so-called recovery began, of the growth of national income that has occurred since the bottom of the recession, workers got 1%. Take all American workers together, they got 1% of the increase of national income. Corporate profits got 88%. And a huge part of that went right back to Wall Street. Wall Street got 40% of all corporate profits. So, yeah, we're rewarding the people that caused the collapse. They're doing just fine. And as your previous guest said, they're just sitting on the profits. And this idea that they're going to run out and start spending those is just crazy. But they appear to have, Wall Street at least, appears to have convinced itself that this is true.
So they've, I keep talking about Smoot-Hawley, and we're going to have a historian on in a little while to talk about it. Because, you know, looking back, and it's pretty hard to, I mean, I don't know what Bernanke thinks about what's going on, but he's apparently a student of the Depression. And it just feels like with all of these indicators out there, with what's happening in Europe, with these prominent people now, you can say, well, if Bill Gross at PIMCO, you know, he's got a bias towards bonds. But if he's saying the entire economy looks like an airplane that's about to stall, and if Meredith Whitney, who's the big guru on municipal bonds, saying that we are in a double dip, and furthermore, there's going to be a cascading of municipal defaults, and that seems to be fairly clear because the stimulus money ran out for the states, and they're starting to lay off, and, you know, we're going to have no police, no fire, no libraries, and here in the state of California, you can't even go to a court anymore. You know, it's all happening, and it all feels to me like this is the third worldization, if you will, of the United States. And the last time the United States was a third world country was during the Depression.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because this looks an awful lot like 1937, but in a lot of ways worse. Roosevelt started tightening fiscal policy for about 6 months, and we crashed in 1937. Most Americans don't know that crash was much steeper than the crash that came in 1929 after the stock market crash. The economy just absolutely collapsed when they tightened fiscal policy, thinking that they had recovered. And the reason I say that it's worse this time is because just think about what they had done in the 30s. They put the New Deal programs into place. They closed down the most insolvent banks. They actually had started reforming the financial system. We've done none of that. We don't have any New Deal programs. We've been getting rid of them. We didn't reform Wall Street. We let them continue doing what they were doing. We bailed them out. But then we let them continue doing exactly what they did in 2007 that caused the crash. So in a lot of ways, yeah, it looks like we didn't even have the recovery that you had in the U.S. from 33 to 37, thanks to the Roosevelt New Deal. We had a very weak recovery that didn't improve the situation of most Americans, and now we're going to collapse.
So you're on the side of those that think that you can connect the dots out there, and that when these people on Wall Street, like Alan Sinai, have said that have made the analogy with the lost decade in Japan, that after the real estate boom burst in Japan in the 1990s, a whole decade of stagnation, which arguably is still going on, followed. So is that an analogy, you think, that the economy really hasn't recovered from the 2008 crash, except the people who caused it? They've all recovered. But does this inevitably mean a lost decade for us? Is that the cause, if you will, you know, the original sin of our current economic distress?
Well, I think we could trace the distress back even further. You know, I might go back to the Carter years. Yeah, we have not recovered. I don't think we are going to have a lost decade like Japan's. And let me just say why. Japan was an exporting country, and it relies on the rest of the world. And yes, it had a downturn, and it has had very weak growth ever since, but still it is relying more or less on the United States and Asian countries to help prop it up, so that things are bad, but they don't go to 1930s style depression. Now, the United States is in a very different situation. We can't rely on the rest of the world to prop us up. If we go down, we take the whole world with us. So I would say the scenario is going to be a much steeper decline, much worse situation than what Japan has seen. And we will not be able to tolerate 10 years of that. So I don't see a 10-year-long depression.
So what do you see, though? Because it seems to me that politically, the only people in this country have political energy are on the far right. There's no energy on the left. There's a lot of disillusionment. The far right are economic illiterates, as we can see from what they were threatening recently, but they play hardball. It has consequences. And a lot of them are driven by libertarian ideas that you just have to destroy the government. We don't need a government. Private enterprise will run it, you know, run the world magically, and we'll all have prosperity. I mean, this is, you know, Jack Kennedy said, you know, a rising tide raises all boats. The tide is not rising. The gulf between the rich and the poor is growing. This is all lunacy and fantasy. The reality is the country seems to be heading, here in California, we're not going to be able to get our day in court. Libraries are closing. These are a series of canaries in the minefield. And I'm not trying to be Chicken Little here. I'm just saying that I think somebody has to connect the dots.
Yeah, I think there are two ways of looking at this. One is that we've got the far right, and they're pushing very hard. They want to dismantle all the New Deal reforms, the safety nets, and that on the other side, we've got the Democrats who are fighting against this. We have Obama in the middle. He had to make a grand compromise. He got the best deal he could in the circumstances. Okay, it's a plausible scenario. Maybe that is what is going on, and we need to rally the Democrats and try to protect what we can, but we realize we're going to lose a lot. Okay, the other possible scenario is, and we talked about this in April when I was last on, I believe, shock doctrine. It could be that this wasn't a compromise at all. It was a foregone conclusion. There was political theater, a smokescreen to hide the fact that the Democrats and Republicans and Obama are working together to get the results they want, which is they want to eliminate the social safety net. And it is looking more and more like that is the reality. Boehner is out there bragging he got 98% of what he wanted. That's not a compromise.
Right, but how could a community activist who's seen, presumably, seen poverty and the results of societal indifference, why would he be more interested in some abstract theory as of balancing the books and getting our fiscal house in order, which was the cliche we heard earlier? Why would he think that's more important than the lives of millions of Americans that is about to be impoverished?
Yeah, well, again, I think there are two plausible scenarios. One is that Obama has really bought into the Clinton line, and your guest also mentioned this, the belief that it was the Clinton budget surpluses that caused the economy to grow rapidly, and that actually did reduce poverty rates a bit. We got the unemployment rate down almost to 1960s levels. Things looked pretty good. And they all claim that the causation goes that direction. It was the fiscal rectitude of Clinton that led to the good economy and allowed average Americans to have the first improvement in their standard of living since the 1960s. Okay, that's possible. And maybe even more probable than the other one, which is there was some sort of a Faustian bargain. It's very clear that Obama was the Wall Street candidate. He got the early Wall Street money.
So was Clinton, though, wasn't he?
That I'm not sure. But
well, he certainly had Rubin and company in there making these decisions that you're talking about, and he got rid of Glass-Steagall. So,
Right. No, he definitely brought all of Wall Street in to his administration.
Right.
That is true. Whether he got the early campaign money, I'm not sure. But
sure,
had Tom Ferguson on your show, and he is the expert on this.
Right.
And he called the election very early when everyone thought that Hillary was going to win. He said, no, Obama got the early Wall Street money. He will be the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And so there could have been a Faustian bargain. Okay, Obama, we are going to elect you, but here is your portfolio. You are going to do the job we've been trying to do since the Reagan years. We're going to kill the New Deal programs once and for all. We need to eliminate these programs in order to make America more competitive in the global economy. And it is plausible.
But let me just got to get this right in my own head because it doesn't make sense to me. How does it improve America's competitiveness if you have not just people, you know, destitute in the streets, but if you have uneducated people with no health care, and no Social Security, what advantage is that? I don't understand what the advantage is, because one of the reasons that GM went broke was that they couldn't afford their health care costs, and they were shifting their plants to Canada, where health care is covered by single payer. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think if we step back and take the bigger picture, you're absolutely right. That what we need to do is to get rid of the private health care system and ramp up Medicare. So rather than shredding Medicare and Medicaid, what we need to do is get single payer like every other developed country in the world has, and that would make us more competitive.
But the Wall Street people are telling, according to your scenario, the Wall Street people are telling Obama, no, we just want to cut it all and cut those people loose. So that we can compete with workers in Sri Lanka, that's the compact.
And I think that to a great extent, a very large part of the American population and workforce are just seen as unnecessary to globalized production.
Right, but they are necessary for consumption because, you know, isn't this a consumer-driven economy? So, you know, I think we're going to have to have this conversation another time. Just as it's getting interesting, I'm afraid we're, you know, running out of time. But I just in closing, I recall Henry Ford's adage, and he was certainly no progressive, that you have to pay your workers enough that they can buy your products.
I know, and unfortunately, I think we've just lost that. I don't believe that that is the way our captains of industry view this anymore. They are looking to China. They are looking to Brazil. They believe that those are going to be the new markets. We don't need American consumers. We don't need an American middle class anymore. I hope I'm absolutely wrong on this, but it is looking more and more like this is the way that they view it. Why else do we have such an attack on the American middle class? If they had the Henry Ford view, they would not be trying to run our economy this way, and they wouldn't be trying to shred the safety nets.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, L. Randall Ray.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with L. Randall Ray, Professor of Economics and Research Director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He also writes regularly for the websites Benziger.com, New Economic Perspectives, and New Deal 2.0. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with an historian, the author of The Great Depression, America, 1929 to 1941.
The moon was all aglow, and heaven was in your eyes. The night that you told me those little white lies, the stars all seemed to know that you didn't mean all those sighs. The night that you told me those little white lies.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Robert McIlvain, who is Professor of History at Millsap College. His books include The Great Depression, America 1929 to 1941, Down and Out in the Great Depression, Letters from the Forgotten Man, and The Encyclopedia of the Great Depression. In 2007, he wrote an extensive analysis of the economic conditions in comparison with those of the 1920s. If economic history doesn't repeat itself, does it rhyme? In which he predicted a coming collapse, similar to what happened in 1929. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert McIlvain.
Glad to be with you.
And since you predicted the crash of 2008 before it happened, I'm calling upon you now to tell us whether this is our Smoot-Hawley moment, in as much as it seems like what happened recently on Capitol Hill, of course, was a travesty. But the solution, the deal, instead of reviving an economy that's distressed, seems to be at least the reaction. If today's reaction on Wall Street is related to it, then it's clearly a repudiation. But what's your sense of whether the Congress, rather than fixing the economy, help dig its grave, as Smoot-Hawley did as the Depression was starting to unravel?
Well, I don't think there's any question about it. The problem is, I did a piece in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago talking about the contrast between fact-based economics and faith-based economics, and the faith that so many of these people have is not in a Judeo-Christian God, but in the market as a god, that it can do no wrong, and that any sort of intervention or regulation or high tax rates amount to sinfulness. And given that sort of faith, facts just don't matter. They're sort of like the people who say that God created the world 6,000 years ago, but when he did it, he put a bunch of fossils around in order to fool people and test their faith. And so if somebody believes something like that, as these people do with the market, you can pile all the facts you want up there, and they will just ignore all of them because they're all false evidence in their view. But what happened in the 1920s, basically, you were talking to the previous guest about Henry Ford and the fact that you need to have people in a consumption-based economy who have enough money to consume what's being produced. In the 1920s, more and more of the income was going to the people at the very top, peaked in 1928-29, during the period in the middle of the 20th century when a substantial and fairly well-to-do middle class was built in the United States. That was not nearly as much of a percentage going to the people at the top. It's peaked again when I wrote that piece in 2007, almost exactly where it was in 1928-29, and it simply doesn't work in a consumption-based economy, whatever one may think of the morality of so much of the income going to people at the top.
So in terms of then, if there are these economic analogies, what about political analogies? Because we certainly, after 2008, we did not have Ferdinand Pecora. We didn't have any kind of investigation. The only person who called for the investigation of Wall Street was the filmmaker who won the Academy Award for the best documentary, Inside Job. Apart from that, there's been a resounding silence on Wall Street, given the massive amounts of fraud that took place. Give us your sense of the politics and why they're different.
Well, it's just mind-boggling. I mean, one of the most striking things to someone like myself as a historian of the era of the Great Depression is that both in terms of politics and in terms of economic philosophy, following the collapse of the whole laissez-faire, social Darwinist sort of approach in 1929, that was really discredited through the New Deal years, but really all the way down basically to the late 1970s and the rise of the people who supported Ronald Reagan. This time, somehow, instead of that being discredited, the people who are pushing that are basically out there saying, well, they may not admit that it's failed several times before, but basically they're saying, let's try it again. And rather than having a New Deal come out of it, we've had the idea of let's go back to the halcyon days of Calvin Coolidge, or even as Karl Rove would like, William McKinley. And it's just absolutely amazing. They seem to not care that it hasn't worked before because they have faith in it. They just want to try it again.
But, you know, there are only a few billionaires in this country, but there are a lot of ordinary people. And I don't understand how, you know, the 1% have convinced the 99% that somehow protecting the interests of the billionaires is your job, and in order to do that, you have to forego health care, pensions, social security, etc., and education. I mean, how? In other words, back then, at least there was a political reaction when people were getting screwed. You know,
yeah,
Hoover was booted
right
out, and Roosevelt came in.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's different, and I think this is important, although it certainly doesn't explain it all, is that there was a very long time between the collapse in 1929 and Roosevelt coming in fact, about 40 months, whereas between the collapse in 2008 and Obama coming in, there was about 4 months. And in some ways, that was better for the country because the stimulus, while it's ridiculed by people on the right, I believe prevented us from falling into another Great Depression in 2009. But because it was such a short time, it's been possible for the right-wing propaganda machine to somehow persuade people that, oh, this is all Obama's fault, it started under him. Nobody had any doubt that it was not Franklin Roosevelt's fault by the time he came in because it had been going on for so long. So I think that difference in the timing is part of it. But the other thing is that the Democrats, the president, and most of the rest of the Democrats have just been so miserable in presenting any sort of a message. And all the facts, sort of things that should get support from the vast majority of the people are on their side, and they just don't seem to be able to do anything with it.
So then what explains, I mean, I understand, you know, you're talking about the the politicians, the failure of the Democratic representatives and the failure of this Democratic president to protect the legacy of the New Deal and to advance the standard of living of people in this country who, millions of people are being sort of arbitrarily downsized and their standard of living is being reduced because of these zealous abstract theories of libertarians and religiously based fundamentalists that you talked about earlier. They're the ones with the energy. I mean, there's not that many people in the Tea Party. In many ways, it's a manufactured fiction anyway. It's just the repackaging of the Republican right. But you have to admit it's been incredibly successful. So the idea that a tiny minority could capture the political energy of this country and the vast majority who are getting screwed are totally supine, I don't get it.
Well, I wish I had a better answer to that. I don't get it either. Some of it has to do, I think, with long-term trends. You can even go back to Richard Nixon and then perhaps back to the Checkers speech in 1952 when, in addition to talking about his dog, he talked about how my wife, Pat, doesn't have a mink coat, but she does have a good Republican cloth coat. And people, Nixon, Joseph McCarthy, and others at the time were identifying a different sort of elite, not Wall Street, against which they wanted to turn the populist anger of middle America. And they didn't succeed in doing it quite then, but as time went by, the Republican Party basically turned to becoming an anti-60s party from about 1968 on, running against what the popular perception of what the 60s was all about, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And they were able to bring a lot of people over to their side on those sorts of issues who were not really people who had anything to gain by supporting them in terms of their economic status. And so they built up this core of people who were opposed to government intervention in terms of allowing abortion or gay rights or what have you. And now, really, they've kind of lost on those issues, at least nationwide, certainly not in some sections of the country. But they've somehow managed to switch to talking about the economic issues and managed to bring those people along with them.
So what and historical analogies then can we take from how people were motivated? I mean, I get the impression here that politics are some kind of Pavlovian process where it just has to get awfully painful for people to get off their backsides and start voting and start getting politically active and organizing. I mean, where do you think that moment will come in this country now as it did back then? Obviously, there was no social safety net in those days. People were in serious distress. Here there is a social safety net, a frayed one, that the Tea Party people and the Republicans, in collusion with the president, it seems, are starting to eviscerate.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the problem, that the president and the Democratic Party are clearly better on most of these things than almost all the Republicans are, but not that much better. I've been saying recently that the Republican Party is a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America, whereas the Democratic Party is perhaps a two-thirds owned subsidiary of corporate America, and so there's a difference, but they are still so close to them that it's not that they didn't accomplish anything.
Well, I'm sorry I'm getting signals here that we're running out of time, but the only point I would make is that if the far right wing of the Republicans can take over the Republican Party, how come the left can't take over this corrupt shell known as the Democratic Party? It just takes numbers and people. I thank you for joining us, Robert McElveen.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert McElveen, who's an expert on the history of the Great Depression. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking with a Wall Streeter, I guess. He's a former Wall Street banker who covers Wall Street for Fortune, Vanity Fair, and New York Times. He wrote the book Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. And spent a decade and a half working for a couple of big Wall Street banks and has been a pretty solid journalist on Wall Street. he gave our audience, I think, a pretty good analysis of what's going on in terms of the technicalities of the 513-point loss in the Dow and all of this other stuff about how overheated the stock market is and how overvalued Facebook and all of these runaway shares, you know, they're not even shares because they're privately held, but how the kind of valuation for much of what's on Wall Street doesn't make any sense. So he thought it was basically letting out a bunch of air. So I try to push him a little further because, you know, when he starts to talk about things like Washington getting its fiscal house in order, it sounds to me like the same kind of Wall Street disconnect from reality. And he did agree, you know, that he thought that I said, well, if it's about Wall Street, about Washington getting its fiscal house in order, maybe it's about something else. You take $2 trillion out of the economy, which is what Obama and the Republicans have agreed on, and suddenly the market crashes. It seems to me to be a vote for recognizing that these clowns in Washington, rather than stimulating the economy, are killing it in order for this abstract need to balance the budget and get rid of these deficits. So we reversed that conversation with Randall Ray, who really did lay out, I think, a very interesting story about what maybe is going on in Washington. And again, like so many people I've talked to lately, he suggested that Obama is very much, he got what he wanted. That's the scary part, that he was the first guy to get money from Wall Street before Hillary Clinton did. And he thinks that a deal was made and that he doesn't really value the social safety net. And that is Wall Street's agenda. They don't want to compete with the rest of the world. You know, in other words, turn Americans into Sri Lankans. Which, of course, doesn't make any sense. You would think that a more educated workforce with single-payer healthcare would make these companies and these big corporations more competitive. After all, General Motors found that it was having to move plants to Canada because it couldn't afford healthcare costs here in the United States. So it's a pretty hard thing to get your head around whether it could be quite that cynical. But it's certainly a possibility that one has to entertain. Then I talked to the historian Robert McIlvaine, the author of The Great Depression, America, 1929-41, to get a sense of whether this is our Smoot-Hawley moment where the Congress has dug the hole deeper instead of fixing the economy. They're putting a stake through its heart. He really was, I thought, outstanding in what he had to say about, with the analogies of the Great Depression and how, you know, we're in this situation now where you really have a kind of bunch of religious nutcases on the right, the Tea Party, who really believe in this economic Darwinism and this. Well, he actually calls it the God of the market. That's what it's up there with Jesus Christ. So they really believe in the God of the market, and that solves all. So I asked him, you know, what's the countervailing strategy? And that's a conversation for another time. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.